Thank you, Mukund. Wonderful. Thank you for making us take an outward view rather than being so inward looking. And we heard this morning from Chris Bowen, in fact, I think the term he used when he was speaking around these types of issues with trade is it's a big ship to turn. What do you think, or what would you call upon this audience to do in meeting these challenges of the future? Melinda touched on this morning also the need for, what is the practical advice if all of us took a message away today, what could we do to build these Asia-capable workforce?
Thanks, Lee. It's a great question. At a really practical level, what we're trying to do is to really drive awareness, drive knowledge, and, as I said, confidence in our ability to execute strategies through greater capabilities. So what does it mean to be more aware? Earlier this week, in conversations with the chairs and, you know, board members of a number of our ASX 50 companies, many of the examples they give of doing business in India, in Indonesia, in mainland China, they're from 10, 15 years ago, right? And these are people in positions of influence who are looking to endorse their organization's strategies going forward. And so the first part of it is to actually have a contemporary understanding of the opportunities in these markets, because we have to understand that the development in many of these markets is completely non-linear. Just building on the example with India. India has 300 million people who don't have reliable supply of electricity. So you've got 300 million people who are just keen to move into the first industrial revolution. But side by side with that, you've got a smart cities agenda, which the Japanese government has pledged $35 billion of funding to, which is one of the most sophisticated industry 4.0 agendas in the world. So you've got 4.0 and 1.0 residing side by side. So if you haven't been to India recently, and you're thinking of India from 15 years ago and a bad meal you had in the Mumbai lounge, I doubt they even had a lounge then, but your views are going to be completely outdated. So the first part is awareness of opportunities with the contemporary understanding. The second bit is the knowledge. I have been absolutely amazed with the use of anecdotes at the senior most levels of leadership to inform whether particular strategies should actually be advanced or not. We have to get back to the use of evidence and having evidence and reason actually drive a lot of our decision-making on whether we want to invest or not invest. And it's perfectly fine, can I also say, to not invest and do business in one or more markets in Asia. But let's just have a considered view as to why we're not doing so. So that's the second part there. And then the third part is the confidence. I always find it amazing when I'm in Asia, you know, pick any country here, and you have a delegation of Australians, and they all gravitate to each other. Right? And no one's really engaging with the counterparts. And that tells me that they're actually lacking the confidence from an intercultural understanding perspective, right? So it's the cross-cultural competencies. You don't need to have the language capabilities. Language capabilities are excellent to have and absolutely essential. And I think I'm delighted that the Honorable Chris Bowen has a policy initiative focused on schools and Asian languages. But for time-poor executives, if you haven't learned an Asian language and you're part of the workforce, it doesn't mean you can't do business in Asia. Sure. You absolutely can. You can learn to become more cross-culturally competent so that you're comfortable in diverse cultural settings. So those are three very practical things that executives in the workforce can actually invest time in by, one, showing up to public discussion forums such as these to become more aware. Two, investing the time to ask the questions which will drive evidence-based decisions. And then three, investing in developing cross-cultural competencies in particular.
Thank you. All important issues. And I'm just going to open it up to the floor for any questions. I'm sure there are many. As you know, if you wouldn't mind just mentioning your name and where you're from and raising your hand, that would be appreciated. Just while we're potentially waiting for that first question, I just wanted to come back to the federal government and just ask, really, what do you think policymakers and indeed industry representations need to prioritise in this next term of government? What should indeed those priorities be?
So I think at a... So I think at a federal level, I have to highlight that actually both sides of politics have actually made a real effort around Asia engagement. Actually, one of the things that, yes, you know, there are specific initiatives that, you know, one can always judge their merits on, but if you look in terms of intent, government, both sides of politics here, have actually been exceptional in committing to our engagement with Asia. So if you think of the current government and their New Colombo plan, it's an absolutely outstanding platform for soft diplomacy. It's going to fundamentally shift the structure of our workforce. We already have almost 40,000 alumni. For those of you not familiar with the New Colombo plan, this is a program which is sending almost 10,000 students in our universities into the Indo-Pacific in short-term and long-term mobility, through short-term and long-term mobility opportunities, and fundamentally changing the way in which our university students have thought about study abroad, which has historically been to either go to Europe or to go to the US for a term. And we already have, and we will have, at the end of this year, 40,000 alumni. Now, think of these students who've all, large number of them, have also done internships while they've been in, you know, in China, in India, and Singapore, entering the workforce. One of the first things they're going to ask, and we've engaged with a number of them on return, is they're going to ask the organizations they're joining, what is your international strategy? Where does Asia fit in? So there's been, you know, some great initiatives from the current government. The Honorable Chris Bowen and Labour, it's great to see a shadow treasurer speaking passionately about foreign policy. And it was great to see that as part of an economic policy agenda there, that, you know, Asian engagement, you know, got a mention. Because, again, there are no votes in foreign affairs. So I was delighted to see that. So I think on both sides, it's there are some really good elements there in their policy making. But it really does come down to business. And government in this country cannot force business to do anything. It's a free market. They can, you know, do studies like they did with the India economic strategy and you know, conclude free trade agreements. But the adoption of it, the willingness to invest time, you know, have a board meeting, for instance, for our listed companies. Our High Commissioner in Singapore, Bruce Gosper, is doing an extraordinary job there to bring Australian companies into the region. And he personally wrote to the chairs of the top 50 ASX companies and said, why don't you come out to Singapore and have a board meeting here?
Yep,
really practical, right? And that's actually gotten boards to actually go into Asia. And Singapore is, of course, Asia light. But why don't we start with that?
It's good to hear Bruce doing that as a former trustee of CEDA here in Sydney. I think there's a question here at the rear of the room. No? Any questions, please? Thank you. Just, again, a reminder to state your name and where you're from.
Hi, Jessie Kelly, CSIRO. You're going to have to stop using light blue boxes for your slides because I couldn't read your white words. Sorry. I want to know, can you tell me more about the export services sector into the future? So what does the makeup of that look like, or what should it look like, and how do you see us getting there?
Sorry, just to clarify, that's export services sector?
Yeah, so you're saying into the future services should make up a large part of export. If we were going to increase export, we should also increase services as part of that, or that's what I understood. And then I'm wondering if you can give me some more detail about what is in that sector, in the services export sector. And that might be covered by your last slide, but maybe you could give some more detail about specifically what we should export, when, and what the majority of services that are desired would be.
Okay. Well, thanks for that. So I'll respond in two parts. The first is services sector, you know, includes, for example, financial services. I mentioned we've got our banks. Several of our banks have been in the region, and some of them, yes, have decided to actually retreat in certain business areas, but are still quite strong in other areas. For instance, in institutional banking. So we have all four of our banks that have some level of exposure to Asian markets. Our insurance companies, our funds management sector, superannuation funds, our fund managers, and others. Healthcare is a huge area, healthcare and aged care, huge opportunities. Professional services, here I'm speaking about the accounting firms, the consulting firms, the legal firms, the engineering construction firms, many of whom already have a presence in Asia, significant opportunities. So there are a number of areas within the services economy, recognizing, as I said, that services makes up 3/4 of our economic performance. And 9 out of 10 jobs are in the services sector. So there are significant opportunities in services with across Asian economies. The other point that I want to make is that we proposed a couple of years ago for a trade and value-added approach when you think of services. Because when we think of services, quite often we stop in this country at, I should mention, the two big flagship area of services, international education and tourism, at which we're exceptionally strong, with even greater potential. But those are examples of direct exports of services. And when we think of services, we like to think of it at 3 levels. One is the direct export of services like international education, you know, international student recruitment. That's a service that leads to students coming here and generating income for our country and for our universities. The second is services embodied in the production of goods and also in the delivery of commodities. How do we get our iron ore from pit to port? It's because of world-class construction and logistics services. And if we were to decouple the value of those services, you would then start to understand the true value of services to actually deliver even on goods. And then the third one is services through foreign affiliate sales. So if we have a bank that's offshore and that's invested, its sales as well should actually be captured because it's the sales of the services economy. And it's the total value of all those 3 categories of services that gives us the total value of services trade. And on that basis, the services trade is actually likely to be greater than both our mining and agricultural trade. So we don't actually reflect the real value of services even in our trade today.
Thank you. Question up here at the back. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Raymond Fan from the Hong Kong Economic and Trade Office. Manu, how are you? Thank you for a very expert advice on a lot of things doing business in Asia. You mentioned a lot of countries, and I thought you have not mentioned Hong Kong, Singapore. You just mentioned Singapore, so I have to raise my hand there. I think in Hong Kong, there's 100,000 Australians living there and 600 companies there already. So maybe you think we're just already an extension of Sydney CBD. But that's a lot of things you just struck me as really intriguing is a lot of people make their business decision based on anecdotes and not on facts, not on statistics. So how AsiaLink and other people can actually bring the facts and the latest information to the Australian business and the politicians also on how to, in a way, make sure they actually are based on something tangible and something actually sustainable and verifiable. Because a lot of the times, the facts are not like secondary.
Raymond, great question, and my apologies for not mentioning Hong Kong. It was totally unintended. So from a Hong Kong perspective, we do spend a lot of time informing the workforce and in particular enterprises about opportunities with that market. And I'll give you one very specific example, right? So Raymond, I've spent quite a bit of time at the Hong Kong Science and Technology Park. And I'm delighted about the plans with the Lok Ma Chau Loop to build a park which will be several times the size of HKSTP. HKSTP, for those of you that don't know, in my opinion, I graduated from MIT, I lived in Kendall Square. HKSTP is every bit as good. It is an absolutely extraordinary park that has attracted universities from all over the world, including the very best US universities like Princeton, which has arguably the best undergraduate engineering program in the US, on par with Caltech and MIT, has decided to establish its international R&D base out of HKSTP because it wants to really target and exploit opportunities in the Asia-Pacific region by doing collaborative research with large multinational companies. And one of the unique things about HKSTP is that it actually has a larger number of medium-sized enterprises than it does large multinational enterprises. So they've got this extraordinary balance of large enterprises, multinational enterprises, medium-sized enterprises, all working together with international universities to commercialize ideas and products and services and take it into the mainland in particular because you've got this extraordinary consumer base there. That's just one example, and it's one that we like to use extensively as a case study, in particular when we run programs and workshops on how do you actually commercialize Australian products and services into the region.
Thank you. There's a question here down the front.
Thank you. Michael Broadhead from Folk. Thank you very much for your presentation and insights this afternoon. We heard earlier from Neville and Chris Bowen discussing the state of the Australia-India relationship when the Shadow Treasurer was talking about developing Asia-relevant capabilities. He mentioned that in 1972, more Australian kids were learning Bahasa in the classroom than today. And I remember it well. I was one of them at the time. Indonesia seemed to loom much larger in terms of relative importance in trade and tourism and defence. So I guess my question is the Australia-Indonesia relationship and are our connections where they need to be today? Do we need to be thinking about something like an Indonesian engagement strategy in a similar manner to the Peter Varghese strategy that you mentioned previously?
So it's a great question. I'll start by answering the last part first. My view is that we actually should have an economic strategy like the Peter Varghese India Economic Strategy. For those of you that are not familiar with it, it's a 504-page document that sets out a 20-year narrative, which is extraordinary long-term thinking with bipartisan political support. I don't think there's any other initiative that has reflected either of those two attributes together. And so I actually think that it's a fantastic idea to have a similar report done with Indonesia as well. The point on languages, again, you know, Chris Bowen is studying Bahasa. He was too polite today to highlight that, but he's in the latter stages of actually graduating from his course where he's actually studying Bahasa, and he's not the only one in the shadow cabinet who's studying an Asian language. So it is possible, but extraordinarily challenging. In terms of our engagement with Indonesia more broadly, there are actually significant pockets of engagement. So notwithstanding the study of Asian languages not being strong, there's a fantastic sister school relationship through the Bridge program with Indonesia. I recommend that you have a look at it, which is one of the flagship programs of DFAT with the Asia Education Foundation, which drives real understanding between schools, in both countries, really deep intercultural understanding. From a business perspective, if IA CHEPA is signed in the next couple of months, that will make a dramatic difference. But again, it's about looking at opportunities by sector, and irrespective of whether there is, and there will be, and there should be, you know, an FTA, it's really driving that awareness of opportunities. So one example of an initiative that we're championing at the moment is we've identified an opportunity with MTP Connect, which is the Industry Growth Center for the federal government. And can I also just say here that when we think of engagement with international economies, and we do a piece of strategy work, we're great at studying the industrial policy of China, studying India's industrial policy. But whenever I speak to people in the know, people in senior positions, and I ask them about Australia's industrial policy, which is owned by our 6 industry growth centers, very few people have actually engaged with our growth centers. And it's a terrific initiative which in one form or another has actually been the brainchild of both sides of politics. An extraordinary group of ex-industry experts who are now working at these growth centers that I strongly encourage you to engage with. And so we're working with the MedTech and Pharma Growth Center. We have identified real opportunities for Australian healthcare companies, particularly medical technology and devices companies, digital health opportunities in Indonesia. Right? So it's very specific, it's very targeted, and it's something that we're looking to execute on this year, not just through a piece of thought leadership, because one of the things that my senior colleague Penny Burton and I, she's the group CEO, we joke about is that AsiaLink and AsiaLink Business, we're not a think tank, we're a do tank, right? I don't get to put up those results and not take accountability for it. I'm also accountable for doing something about the fact that 67% of ASX 200 board members, you know, don't have Asia-related experience, which means that we got to do a better job at AsiaLink of actually advocating why that on-the-ground experience is necessary. So there are certainly pockets, but it's about targeting those niche areas, and IA CHIPA from a business perspective will make a big difference.
Thank you. And one final question right here at the rear.
Anna Booth, New Zealand Trade and Enterprise. Thank you, McCon, for a very interesting talk. You spoke about how these loud anecdotes are sort of driving people's behaviour, and I was wondering whether you have any insights into mistakes that companies often make that lead to failures that mean that there are people who carry this these anecdotes.
Sorry, I missed that last part. Could you repeat that, please?
Have you got any insights into common mistakes that people or companies make when they're expanding into Asia that lead to failures that drive these anecdotes?
So the thing with the international failures of Australian firms is that it's not unique only to Asian markets. We've had a number of Australian firms that have also failed in the UK. True. They've also failed in other parts of Europe, and they've also failed in the US. So it's not unique to Asia. That's the first thing. As we've had a number of Australian firms also succeed across international markets, including in Asia, and I give that example of A2 Milk. I put up a slide which highlighted the pathways to success. And those pathways reflected the sorts of things that we have to start doing that we perhaps haven't done, especially in those instances where we've not been as successful. Right? And one of those elements is actually moving away from anecdotes. And a lot of the anecdotes, one, are driven often by outdated experiences, and two, driven by public sentiment. So we also have to be conscious of public sentiment, media reporting, questioning the quality of reporting, to actually stop and say, okay, is there a bit more here that is reflected around the success or failure of this organization beyond a 700-word op-ed, which is likely to be the case if it's a multi-billion dollar investment. So it's about actually going to that next level of detail, which can then actually inform more evidence-based decision-making, which is what we'd really like to see.
Thank you, Mukund. Mukund, I knew that your address today would not disappoint, and thank you for drawing all of our attention into the room on the our awareness of opportunity. It really, we are in the most ideally placed part of the world for this next era. And your practical insights, the suggestions around pathways to success, I think have given all of us in the room something to take away. It is an exciting time for all of us. You've heard to go and have your board meetings in Asia. The call has been made, so the first practical step you can implement is in fact doing so. But Mukund, again, thank you for your time. Ladies and gentlemen, our Economic and Political Outlook does contain a number of chapters around the international environment, and I encourage all of you to take a copy away with you today. But in closing this afternoon, could you please join me in thanking Mukund for his time.